A cliff is a significant vertical or near vertical rock exposure. A fiscal cliff is a significant vertical or near vertical exposure to recession, massive tax increases, and wide-ranging cuts in government expenditure, all happening at once. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, our panel of economists from UMKC help us make sense of and demystify the implications of the so-called fiscal cliff. They'll tell us what it means for our economy and the ongoing credibility of domestic fiscal policy. There's also another debt ceiling debate looming in the foreground, which is weird because how do you fall off a cliff toward a ceiling? We'll attempt to answer those questions and many more on Central Standard after this hour's NPR News. On December 31st, two balls could drop. One will most certainly be in New York's Times Square to celebrate the new year. The other ball is a lot more uncertain in the respect that people are wondering, will Congress drop the proverbial economic and fiscal policy ball over a proverbial and steep cliff? A fiscal cliff. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Avoiding the January 1st fiscal cliff of huge simultaneous spending cuts and tax hikes is a key to a positive forecast, according to the head of research for the Mid-America Regional Council, Frank Link. Today, we have the fiscal cliffhanger conversation with our team of economic outlaws from UMKC. Joining us now are UMKC economics professors Stephanie Kelton and Matt Forstutter. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Stephanie, what is the fiscal cliff?
Well, the fiscal cliff is a series of changes that are set to take effect at the start of the new year that have to do with cuts in government spending and tax increases, a wide variety of things that are set to automatically go into effect at the start of the new year.
Simultaneously, though.
Yeah, well, if we hit the fiscal cliff and we don't strike any kind of a deal to avoid it, then at the start of the new year, a number of things go into effect. Some of those policy changes, some of the tax increases and some of the spending cuts won't be felt immediately, but others will. So it's sort of a cliff for some and maybe more of a slope as it's been described for others.
Matt Forstutter, is this simultaneous tax increase and spending cut mechanism, is it unprecedented?
Well, I wouldn't say it's completely unprecedented, but it really, I can't remember anything exactly like this happening. I don't know. The debates about other fiscal changes, but occasionally you have some of these situations where some automatic changes, such as whether or not the Bush tax cuts were going to be extended and things like that. So I can't remember anything exactly like this, but you had some similar situations.
Some experts have argued that going over the cliff wouldn't cause so much immediate economic harm that any damage could quickly be reversed by retroactively, for instance, waiving the tax increases and spending cuts. Is this true, Stephanie Kelton?
Well, it's true for some, as I said, and it's not true for others. I mean, these experts say some things like, well, you know, if the Bush tax cuts expire, nobody's going to feel that unless and until those tax cuts aren't reinstated and April 15th rolls around and you actually end up paying higher taxes. So you don't feel it on January 1st, but you feel it, you know, with a delay unless something's done. Other people are going to feel this immediately because part of what the fiscal cliff involves is, you know, President Obama and Congress passed legislation that reduced the payroll tax withholding by 2 percentage points. It's not a lot for an individual, but it's a lot in the aggregate. And one of the things that's set to expire is that payroll tax cut of 2%. Now, that goes into effect immediately. So in your first paycheck in January, a whole lot of folks, in fact, an awful lot of folks, because everybody who works pays into Social Security, right? You have that FICA withholding. So depending on how much money you make, you're going to have more or less of it in your pocket because that 2% cut may go away. Other people who are receiving unemployment benefits, the long-term unemployed. There is legislation that allowed us to extend unemployment benefits for the very long-term unemployed. Now, if we hit the cliff, that also goes away. So if you're one of those people who's getting a $300, $350 every month check and the check stops, for you, that's an immediate effect. That's a cliff for you at the start of the new year.
How would a drop off the fiscal cliff, over the cliff, as it were, affect the federal budget, Matt Forstater?
Well, they people think that when you cut government spending and raise taxes that you're going to cause the deficit to shrink. But what happens is that when you do these things, they have secondary effects that end up feeding back on the federal budget. So if people have higher taxes, then they spend less. And when they spend less, there's less economic activity. And so incomes fall. And so then that has a secondary effect that causes tax revenues to fall. And when government spending goes down, then government is buying less desks and chairs and other things. And so sales go down and incomes go down. And so then again, economic activity goes down. And then so the deficit is to some extent determined by the level of activity, of economic activity. And so if these initial actions that are intended to cause the deficit to shrink end up having an impact on economic activity, that can end up – you can actually end up unintentionally causing the opposite of what you meant.
Talk about those ancillary effects, if you will. Elaborate on that, Stephanie Kelton.
Well, I think Matt described it really well, and I don't think there are very many economists out there who would dispute what Matt just described. I mean, the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, has already indicated what the likely effects of going over the cliff would be with the full effects of the cliff. In other words, if you have the sequestration, which involves across-the-board cuts to discretionary spending, the expiration of the Bush tax cuts, the payroll tax cut goes away, unemployment compensation, that whole range of things that's set to happen. If all of that goes into effect, the CBO said there's absolutely no way the U.S. avoids a recession. We go back into recession. And it's for exactly the reasons that Matt just described. So, you know, you have this idea that, well, if we want the deficit to shrink, we just spend less and we raise revenue and the deficit shrinks. But we look around other parts of the world, we see what's been happening in Europe, right? They've been trying to do exactly this kind of thing, bring their deficits under control by imposing austerity, variety of cuts to government spending and tax increases. Their deficits are getting bigger and their debts are getting bigger. And so for exactly the reasons that Matt talked about, the economic activity goes down. And as a result of that, tax receipts end up going down instead of up.
How deep a recession are we looking at if this fiscal cliff causes a drop-off in GDP
growth? If nothing's done, if the full effects of all of the changes go into place, the CBO's estimate is that unemployment increases to about 9.1% and that GDP falls by 1.5%. That's our rate of growth of GDP. So we turn negative and the economy begins to contract by about 1% or more.
You're listening to the Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. It's the Fiscal Cliffhanger Show as our team of economic experts weigh in on the potential fiscal policy crisis and its economic implications. Our guests are UMKC economics professor Stephanie Kelton and Matt Forstater. Kansas City, what are your thoughts on the looming fiscal cliff? Do you think it's a money problem? Do you think it's a policy problem? Do you think it's a political problem? Or do you even think it's a problem at all? We'd like you to call in with your comments, questions, and concerns at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Facebook is also an option. Our Twitter handle is at KCURCST. And you can also write in your thoughts on the fiscal cliff at centralstandard@kcur.org. How do we get to this point of there even being the possibility of a fiscal cliff in the first place? Stephanie?
Well, this was part of what happened the last time Congress couldn't come to agreement about raising the debt ceiling limit. And so this is what happens when two sides who understand very little about the monetary system and what the deficit actually is all about can't reach any agreement. And they say, well, all right, we'll increase the debt ceiling limit, but only on the promise that we begin to get these deficits and this debt under control in the near term. And so in order to make sure that we force ourselves to get serious about the deficit and the debt, we're going to put into place a whole series of things that are going to happen with or without us. Okay, so that's how we got here.
Sort of fail-safe button, sort of self-destruct button.
Exactly. That nobody actually now that we're facing the darn thing, nobody wants to go over it. And so what they're trying to do is engineer some sort of a bargain to avoid having those automatic cuts to government spending and increases in taxes go into effect. And my concern, quite frankly, is that the deal is going to be as bad potentially or worse than what would actually take place if we went over the cliff.
Stephanie, you mentioned European austerity in the European Union. We look at cases such as Greece. We look at what potentially could happen to Italy and Spain and some of the other countries that are in peril with the deficit being out of balance with their gross domestic product. Are there any historical comparisons between what they're doing now and what the U.S. has done up to this point?
Well, I'm not sure I completely follow with respect to what...
Has the U.S. ever been through something similar?
Well, there certainly have been times where governments attempted to raise taxes in order to deal with, you know, spiraling out of control, so-called budget deficits and so forth. Yeah, there have been things like that, but nothing on the order of what's taking place in the Eurozone. That's a completely different creature over there. And, you know, in so many ways, we're looking at ourselves as what could potentially happen to us if we don't begin to get our budgets under control. And so we look across the pond and we say, you know, look at what's happened to Greece. My God, look what's happened to Spain and Portugal. If we don't begin to rein in deficits and if we don't start imposing some constraints now, we're going to end up like these guys. But we forget that we're completely different from these countries over here. And the reason that we're completely different is because all of these countries are spending in a currency that they can't issue. They're borrowing in a currency that they don't create. And when the time comes to make good on those payments, they actually can't come up with the euro because they don't issue the euro. And we're in a completely different boat over here. All of our spending is done in U.S. dollars. We borrow in U.S. dollars, and the U.S. dollar comes from the U.S. government. It doesn't come from China, okay? So we can always make the payments. People like Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke have been very candid on this point. They say there's absolutely no way for the U.S. government to become insolvent, in other words, to go broke in its own currency. But we act like we're them, and we're really completely different.
And yet the coupling of global economies and financial markets closely watching other economies has brought that sort of fear-based ethos into our political and policy discussions.
Well, I think for a variety of reasons, a lot of folks actually want to see cuts, and they want to see cuts to very specific programs. And entitlements aren't on the table with the fiscal cliff. Programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, those don't get attacked if we hit the fiscal cliff. They may well be under attack if we engineer some sort of a grand bargain to avoid going over the cliff. And so, you know, people will use Greece and the fear of becoming the next Greece in order to create the hysteria that allows them to say, we better do something, we better do it fast. And the worst decisions that you can make are the ones that you make in haste, right? When you're full of anxiety and you're in a panic mode, this is not when you make your best decisions.
This is the Fiscal Cliffhanger Show here on Central Standard today. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. We want to know what you think, Kansas City, of the fiscal cliff. Is it a money problem, a policy problem, a political problem, or no problem at all? We'd like to hear from you. Also on Facebook as well as Twitter at KCURCST is our handle on Twitter. And you can write in at centralstandard@kcur.org. Bill in Overland Park, welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks, Giovanni. Great show. And Professor, you make a great point. I'd never considered that if we make these draconian cuts, we're going to face the prospect of, as some of the countries in the Eurozone, of, you know, going deeper and deeper in the problem. But let me ask you this question. Not be more prudent to attack the problem from the tax code, get some reform in the tax code. For instance, it's crazy that the NFL is a not-for-profit organization with $9 billion in revenues did not pay up to $44 million in federal taxes last year. Isn't that part of the problem that we're looking at?
That's a good question from Bill in Overland Park. A very convoluted tax code.
Well, I think that what Bill raises a fair point, but at the end of the day, I think you have to step back and ask, what is the problem that we're actually trying to solve? You know, some people will define the problem as out-of-control deficits, out-of-control debt, but why do we believe that? Why do we believe that the debt is, in fact, a problem? Why do we believe the deficit is a problem? We don't have any problem servicing the debt. We don't have any problem paying for the kinds of things that we want to pay for because, again, the U.S. dollar comes from the U.S. government. Where is the crisis? We're told we have a debt crisis. You have a debt crisis when you can't pay your bills. We don't have this problem. We do have problems with the tax code, and there are issues about fairness and all of those sorts of things. And so you can have a really legitimate conversation about that. But in terms of needing the government to increase taxes on certain groups in order to be able to afford to pay for things, that just simply isn't the case.
Matt Forsyter, what are your thoughts on reforming the tax code as a big solution to some of these pretty contentious issues?
Well, I think, again, like Stephanie says, the issue is one of the way that we conceive of the entire problem. In our department at UMKC, we take an approach to government budgets that's known as functional finance. And according to functional finance, you should only look at the effects of any particular relationship between government spending and taxes, or whether the debt is getting bigger or smaller, or of any particular policy. And so the deficit in and of itself is meaningless. It's what are the effects of a larger or a smaller deficit? Does it – if you have a great economy but you have a large deficit, who cares? And if you have a balanced budget but your economy is in shambles and unemployment is high, then who cares that you have a balanced budget? So what matters are the effects of the policy. Now, questions of the tax code, that's kind of a separate issue then. According to functional finance, taxes should only be imposed in order to affect people's behavior. And so if you want people to smoke less, you can tax cigarettes. And then the ideal revenue is actually zero because it's not a revenue generating tax. It's a tax to affect people's behavior. And so this is the approach that we take, and it allows you to really understand government budgets and the way the monetary system works in a completely new way.
Speaking of the effects of deficit reduction or deficit implosion, whatever it may be, you have a background in African-American studies and African-American economic history. This recession has been disproportionately hard on Black Americans and other minority groups. How does this looming fiscal cliff affect that community?
Right. Well, historically disadvantaged groups like African-Americans, whose unemployment rate is always double, and that's the official rate that doesn't count everyone, so that the BLS has alternative unemployment rates that count additional people. And so the actual real unemployment rates are just through the roof, especially for certain gender and age groups like young Black males, 16 to 24. The actual true unemployment rates are just astronomical. And so whenever you have a downturn, it's always hurts African-Americans and hits African-Americans harder than other groups. African-Americans bear a disproportionate burden of economic hard times, and they do not get a fair share of economic good times. Part of it is in the way that our job queue or the job waiting line works. Most people think of a waiting line as working that the people who showed up later get in the back of the line. That's fair. Well, the way the job queue works is that the people who are most recently laid off, they go to the front of the line. And so the people who are in the back of the line, like African-Americans, have to wait and wait and wait. And so it's the old first fired and last hired kind of situation.
And certainly cuts in unemployment benefits and an increase in taxes would exacerbate that situation.
Absolutely. So whenever there is any economic hard times, blacks bear a disproportionate burden.
Let's go to Bob in Fairway, Kansas. Bob, welcome to Central Standard.
Oh, hey, thanks a lot. Hey, I was just going to point out that what Stephanie said is that we don't have to worry about our debt, paying our debts, because we can pay them. Well, Greece didn't have to worry about paying their debts either until they had to start paying 7% interest because they had such a bad rating. They kept jacking the interest rate up on them. And although I understand where she's coming from, that, you know, it's unlikely we would ever have to pay that kind of a rate. It's kind of a teeter-totter, and we need to balance things. And that, I think, is the real crisis or fear, is that our ratings will be cut even worse if we don't get by the ratings agencies, or they should be anyway, if we don't get things, if we don't make changes.
That's a good point from Bob. The major credit rating agencies such as Moody and Fitch have downgraded recently U.S. debt based on these fears. And he's talking about the psychology of the markets.
All right. Well, let me remind everybody again, because he's comparing the U.S. to Greece. And the reason that Greece is in so much trouble and the reason that Greece faces such high rates of interest is because bond markets have figured out that the Greek government is borrowing in a foreign currency. And so in order to lend to the Greek government, the bond market wants to be compensated for the risk of default because they recognize that the euro doesn't come from Greece. And so if you're promising to pay me euros and you can't always create the euro when you need to, you're going to have to pay me a risk premium. And so that's why those high interest rates, that's why the bond vigilantes have lots of power in the eurozone and absolutely no power in the U.S., no power in Japan, no power in the U.K. And that's why you can look around. You know, look at Japan. Debt to GDP ratio is twice that of the U.S. It's 200% of GDP. Japan's interest rates are zero short term, longer term 1%, exactly where ours are. Not only that, they've been there for decades.
Because the Bank of Japan can issue
additional
yen.
The Japanese government borrows in yen, and the yen comes from Japan. Greece borrows in euros, and the euro doesn't come from Greece. And so that's a very, very important point. The second point is that when rating agencies downgraded U.S. treasuries, the effect the following day was for U.S. interest rates to go where? Down, not up. And so we are just fundamentally different from these countries in the eurozone. We set our own interest rates and we issue our own currency.
A lot of callers and listeners have made the point that the government doesn't print money. It's actually the Fed, which is a private bank that prints money. Can you address this?
Well, okay, the Fed, you can call the Fed quasi-private, but when your board of governors is appointed by the President of the United States and subject to Senate confirmation, when you turn over all of your profits to the U.S. Treasury, you don't sound or look very much like a private entity to me. And actually, I love this July 18th appearance by Ben Bernanke before the House Financial Services Committee. And he's sitting there and he's being grilled on a variety of issues. And Bernanke at one point looks at the congressman and he says, "Of course, we'll do whatever Congress tells us to do." Hey, does that sound like an independent central bank to you when the chairman of the Fed says, "We'll do whatever you tell us to do"?
At the same time, Professor Kelton, people from your very department have talked about the lack of transparency at the Fed in terms of their quantitative easing strategies, in terms of their issuing currency and keeping interest rate down, in terms of a fluid sort of monetary policy that isn't overseen by any government body. Can you address
that? Well, there are certainly things that the Fed has done that have not been entirely transparent. Congress could always require the Fed to be more transparent. But I think the Fed's been quite transparent with respect to interest rate policy. In fact, they're bending over backwards to try to let the world know where they intend to have interest rates for, you know, this year and probably through the end of next year as well.
But the backstopping of toxic debt, not so much.
Well, I think, again, the Fed's said we're going to buy $40 billion every single month, you know, of U.S. treasuries. And before that, we're going to soak up a bunch of mortgage-backed securities. We're going to get these things off your books. The swap line, okay, there were some, you know, questions about exactly who the Fed was lending to and how much. But, you know, the U.S. dollar comes from the U.S. government. The Fed issues the currency, okay, obviously, but government spending adds to the U.S. money supply. If the government spends $100 and collects $90 in taxes, that extra $10 went somewhere. And where it goes is into the non-government sector.
Let's go to Vicente in Olathe. Excuse me, Don in Overland Park. Don, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thank you. It seems to me that they could break the problem up and not. I think, of course, it's hard to tell what they're going to do for a solution, but I think they should keep the tax. Go back to the Bush tax rates. I mean, our economy was pretty good back in the 90s. I didn't have any complaints about it. I was working, and lots of people were. And it seems to me that they can address these issues separately, and I think they're going to come up with a bad deal when they try to lump them all together. And I've never seen such an intense display of propaganda, you know, an attempt at persuasion. I mean, the whole concept of a fiscal cliff is it's an alarmist attempt.
Good point made by Don. What do you think of that?
Well, I want to be very careful. It is true that when marginal tax rates were higher, go back to the Clinton years, that the economy was doing well. If by well you mean we had low unemployment rates, the official rate of unemployment was 3.7%, inflation was nowhere to be seen, productivity growth was high, the economy was growing. I mean, this was sort of the Goldilocks economy as it was described back then. But you have to ask yourself how we got there. Okay, some people look at the fact that President Clinton ran budget surpluses for a number of years. And the correlation to them looks like, well, budget surpluses got us a very good economy. And the reverse is actually true. The very good economy got us those budget surpluses. Okay, he loves to go around and tell everybody how wonderful and fiscally responsible he was because he was able to balance the budget and get surpluses. He didn't build those surpluses. Those surpluses were built on the backs of the private sector, which went into debt on an unprecedented level at that time. So we were spending far more than our income as a private sector as a whole, driving ourselves deeper and deeper into debt to finance this expansion that produced for a time a pretty good economy. The problem is it's unsustainable and it ended in recession.
And that, of course, is the linchpin of a lot of economic theorists here at UMKC, that the government actually needs to spend and that a surplus is not like a household budget.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, the only way that one sector in the economy can run a surplus is if some other sector in the economy runs a deficit. So when the federal government was in surplus, the private sector was in deficit. The problem is that the private sector can't go on period after period spending more than its income because we're users of the currency. We don't issue the currency. We can't sustain debt for that period of time, increasing deficit spending. The federal government, in contrast, is almost always in deficit, and that results in our surplus.
We're talking about the potential implications of the fiscal cliff and other economic policy issues with our UMKC economics professors, Stephanie Kelton and Matt Forstatter. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we talk about the reaction of Wall Street and the business community and also the possible redux of debt ceiling negotiations. That's right, another potential debate on the debt ceiling. And we'll find out if the Satan sandwich that Congressman Emanuel Cleaver spoke about, the debt ceiling, will actually become a double decker. Meanwhile, Kansas City, what are your thoughts on the looming fiscal cliff? Do you see a compromise on the horizon? What is your confidence in our government to resolve it and why? And do you even see a problem at all? Call in at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up on Facebook or Twitter at KCURCST. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. According to a recent Wall Street Journal review, half of the nation's 40 biggest publicly traded corporate spenders have announced plans to curtail capital expenditures this year or next year. What a coincidence, because tax increases and spending cuts brought to you by the federal government could curtail economic growth next year as well. We now continue the fiscal cliffhanger conversation with our team of economic outlaws from UMKC. Joining us now are UMKC economics professors Stephanie Kelton and Matt Forstatter. Kansas City, what's your take on the looming fiscal cliff and what it could mean? What are your questions for our team of experts? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. We're going to go to Vicente in Olathe, Kansas. Welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you, Jelani Dafal. I had a small comment to make, two things. One, I think Professor Stephanie is right on target on what she's saying, and the other professor who made the complete analysis on how it could serve as a boomerang effect, the tax hikes, the spending, and everything he said. I don't think I have that much time to repeat everything he said. One of the things that I think are going on in the fiscal cliff is that we have a polarized political stanza as opposed to an economic stanza in the horizon. We can think back to the Carter years. We can think back to the Latin American crisis, which vis-a-vis, it's a kind of like a simile to the Greece and all the other European countries that are taking place. The underlying matter of what Professor Stephanie says is we have to look back at the Bretton Woods Agreement. The U.S. is the currency that is used as a backup currency. We're no longer on a gold standard, or even the euro itself. She can correct me if I'm wrong. It has a big portion of its valuation of that currency in dollars. So the U.S. is the holds the currency at hand. So we're kind of like moving in a direction that is actually not moving in a good economic policy or fiscal policy or monetary policy in this case. The whirlspin that hit the fan was the capital markets. The capital markets in the U.S. was the one connector into the other capital markets around the world, which blew everything out of proportion.
Vicente brings up two interesting key points. One, he mentions Bretton Woods, which established the dollar as the reserve currency around the world, and that was earlier in the 20th century. And so we have sort of a responsibility globally. And with that, he mentions the financial markets. So what's your take on how financial markets have reacted out of the culture of fear surrounding fiscal policy in the U.S. and to some degree in Europe? What do you make of that?
Well, when there's lots of fear and investors are looking for a place to park their money, they go to the safe haven. And the safe haven is the U.S. dollar and it's U.S. treasuries. And the reason that they feel so safe putting their money, parking their money in U.S. treasuries is because they know the U.S. government is always going to make the payment. There's no risk of default when you put dollars into U.S. treasuries. And so that's a good point. Look, the point about Bretton Woods, the Bretton Woods system was a system of fixed exchange rates that was put into place in 1944 after World War II. And it was in place until Nixon took us off the system in the early 1970s. And when we were on the Bretton Woods system, the U.S. dollar was convertible into gold. And so it was effectively a gold standard. Okay, beginning in 1971, we started to move off of that. Nixon took us off. Ever since then, we've had what we call just a flexible floating exchange rate, pure fiat money. But we run our policy as a gold standard policy. So we act
like... And is that the fundamental problem?
That's the fundamental problem. The fiscal space opened up for us after 1971. All of this extra room was created by virtue of the fact that we took control of our own currency. We no longer pledged to convert it into something that is finite in its existence. And we act as if we're still hamstrung by the rules that applied under the old system. And so we don't recognize the fiscal space that we now have. We don't take advantage of it. And so we look around and we see 23 million Americans who want full-time work and can't find it. We see a fragile economy and we say, now is a good time for austerity because otherwise we're going to have problems, you know, paying our debt. I mean, it's just absolutely crazy. It's irresponsible.
Hillary in the West Plaza, welcome to Central Standard. We don't have Hillary in the West Plaza. So let's go to this question. Many have said that the fiscal cliff has been a long time coming. You've established today Stephanie and Matt, how we got here. Can it be avoided entirely, or can we lower the distance we would fall? What's the best move Congress can make here in the run-up to this very historic and contentious fiscal policy debate?
Well, I mean, the best thing, I think, is if they would decide to not allow the tax rates to rise and not allow the government spending to go down, but to do that without having any type of other agreement that just extends the austerity deadline another year or 6 months or whatever. So, I mean, the best thing that we right now actually need a larger deficit. The economy needs a larger deficit, not a smaller deficit. So any attempt to go in the opposite direction from that would have negative effects on the economy.
What is the worst scenario, Stephanie Kelton, for both the revenue increase side and the spending cut side?
Well, I think the worst case scenario probably is that lawmakers strike some sort of a deal to avoid the fiscal cliff. And I know that sounds probably crazy because, you know, the population has watched Washington gridlock and partisan politics and so forth for so long that the idea that both sides could sit down and work out a deal and that there would be compromise and all of this sounds like very adult behavior. It sounds like something you would be supportive of. But if what they're actually going to put together is a deal that's worse than the one that we face if we actually go off the cliff, then that's actually not something we ought to be supporting. And what I'm most concerned about, I think, is that entitlements become part of that deal, that the president says, if I want the Republicans to come on board, I've got to give them what they want more than anything else in the world. And that actually is entitlement reform. And that's going to mean very painful cuts to Social Security, Medicare, in particular Social Security. I think that is what I'm most concerned about.
The Social Security cuts.
Yeah, because, look, Social Security is a hugely important and successful program. And lawmakers on the conservative side have for a very, very long time wanted to get at Social Security. And the only person who can deliver on that is a Democratic president. No Republican president could deliver Social Security to Wall Street. And that's really what this is about. Wall Street wants their hands on Social Security. But a Democratic president can do that. And that's what I'm most concerned about. This is a program that keeps millions and millions of seniors out of poverty. And if it weren't for Social Security, they would be in poverty. And I know that the changes wouldn't affect those that are already receiving benefits and those that are close to getting their benefits, but it would affect millions and millions of young people. And it's just a nonsense sort of a proposition to have entitlements on the table.
Let's get Matt Forstetter back into this question. Do you agree with that worst case scenario? And if so, also elaborate on what your worst case scenario would be.
Right. Well, no, I agree 100%. I don't know if you remember, but one of the economic advisors in the Reagan administration, David Stockman, when he wrote his memoir, he alleged that the Reagan administration understood that when they instituted their tax cuts, that this would not actually result in the economic growth and the closing of the budget deficit that their economic theory claimed, but rather because they were intentionally trying to, quote unquote, bankrupt the government because they had behind this a anti-government ideology, and that the only way they would ever be able to downsize government is if they convinced everyone that government was bankrupt. And there's still a similar kind of a situation that's going on. People who understand probably that there's not really a threat of the U.S. going broke, becoming Greece, and so on, because they have a small government ideology, they want to try to force this issue from whatever angle they can, and if they can do it. So there have been people who have been against Social Security from day one, from the day it was enacted. And they would like to see Social Security done away with, not because it's an economic necessity to do away with it. Actually, it's an economic necessity to have Social Security. Not only does it support all the people, as Stephanie said, but in addition, it supports the economy, because when people get – that's income that people use to spend. So, I mean, it would be an absolute disaster to do any of the things that they would like to so-called reform Social Security.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. It's the Fiscal Cliffhanger Show, as our team of economic experts weighs in on the potential fiscal policy crisis and its economic and monetary implications. Our guests are UMKC economics professors Stephanie Kelton and Matt Forstatter. Kansas City, what are your thoughts on the looming fiscal cliff? Are you concerned, apathetic, or incensed? Do you have a simple solution that policymakers are missing, that you feel is missing from the discussion? How do you perceive falling off the fiscal cliff will affect you personally? Share with us by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also write into us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Let's go to Jeannie in Kansas. Jeannie, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I live in Kansas, and I was wondering, it seems like the Governor Brownback's budget idea seems like a kind of an extreme model of austerity, and I wondered, I live in a rural community, and I think a lot of people here are afraid that while he's promising very low taxes, there are a lot of us that are worried that this means we'll be paying $500 for public schools every semester or something like that, and just shifting that cost off into individuals. And I'm just wondering if the Kansas experiment is sort of a model of what it might be if we went that direction nationally.
This is a very interesting point that Jeannie brings up, because in this case, inside the United States, Kansas is actually more like Greece.
Well, exactly. Kansas can't issue the currency. It is the user of the currency, just like a household or a private business. Look, her instincts are correct. It is likely, in fact, I would say it's almost certain that if the state of Kansas eliminates the state income tax, that people like her are going to end up paying more in order to keep their schools funded the way they want them funded. The idea is we brought in, Governor Brownback brought in Arthur Laffer, who's a well-known economist and famously developed, according to the stories, the Laffer curve on the back of a napkin. The idea here is that if you reduce taxes, you actually end up with more tax revenue. So you have more money to spend by lowering marginal tax rates. And so the state of Kansas brought Arthur Laffer in and said, would you give us some advice? We're considering lowering the tax in the state of Kansas. It's like going to your barber and asking if he thinks you need a haircut. You know, what do you think Arthur Laffer is going to say? So, of course, he said, great idea. You should lower taxes because you'll end up with more tax revenue. This is not likely to happen. And so I think her instincts are exactly correct. It means austerity. It's a sort of, as Matt said, starve the beast. It's that ideology that you want to actually starve the state of funds so that you can then justify the cuts to education and other programs that you simply don't want to support.
Matt,
the Laffer curve was actually the economic theory that I just mentioned that David Stockman claimed in his memoir that the Reagan administration knew that would not work, yet wanted to justify the tax cuts that then would bankrupt the government. Because during the 1980s, during the Reagan administration, the deficits increased and the national debt increased at unprecedented levels. What happened during that period was that the Democrats decided they would use that opportunity to call the Republicans fiscally irresponsible. And that was a historic moment in all of this, because traditionally the Democrats had been relatively more sensible when it came to these issues of deficits and so on. But after they said, now that they called the Republicans fiscally irresponsible, then since that time, the Democrats and Republicans have both been trying to out fiscally responsible one another and out fiscally responsible our economy right down the tubes. And it was interesting. One of my students, when I explained that pretty much all Democrats and Republicans view the deficits and the national debt in the same way, said that, well, anything that the two parties agree on must be wrong.
Richard in Midtown, welcome to Central Standard. We have Richard in Midtown. Richard?
Oh, yeah, sorry. The thing I approach I kind of like is the Simpson-Bowles approach, that it's not just any one thing. It needs to be revenues. It needs to be some cuts, and especially in the big things like defense and Medicare, you know, maybe if it's just means testing or something like that. And I wondered if your commentators could, you know, what if they like Simpson-Bowles, and if not, and if there's two to three things they would change with it, what they would do.
Simpson-Bowles, a piecemealing of a lot of the contentious issues on the revenue side and the spending side. Talk about that.
Well, so Simpson-Bowles would have, I think, catastrophic effects on the U.S. economy. This is a proposal that couldn't even pass its own commission. I mean, no, the people on the commission wouldn't even support it. The idea is $4 trillion in cuts to the deficit over the course of the next 10 years. And entitlements are front and center in that proposal. And we've spent a lot of time already talking about why entitlements should not be on the table. So Simpson and Bowles is just austerity. Every single dollar that isn't spent by the government is a dollar that isn't received by someone. Every dollar of tax increase is a dollar out of someone's pocket that they no longer have to spend. If you needed to cut the deficit, as Matt talked about earlier, because you wanted certain economic outcomes, in other words, if you didn't have any unemployment and you started having inflationary pressure because people were just spending too much money, that's the time for austerity. That's the time for tax increases or cuts to government spending. You don't cut the deficit when you have 23 million people who want to work and 8.1% unemployment and lots of spare capacity in the economy. Our corporations, our factories in the U.S. aren't operating anywhere near full capacity. They're nowhere near their historically high averages. We simply have all kinds of slack in the economy. This is not the time to start talking about ways to balance the budget.
And we've said in this broadcast, because of fears around austerity, because of fears around the lack of cooperation among members of Congress to get some type of agreement done, that businesses are actually forecasting cuts in expenditure. So I think that's important to note. But going forward, amid the wrangling over the severity and nature of the fiscal cliff, is another debt ceiling debate. Talk about that.
Well, it's just time and again, they will set a ceiling on the debt, and we have the same thing happen every time. They have to extend it. But the entire discussion is completely absurd if you understand what we're trying to communicate. It's very hard for people to change the way that they think about the federal government, the monetary system, and the budgetary system. Actually, if people really wanted to reduce the deficit, the thing that they would be supporting is full employment, because a lot of the deficit is actually due to the fact that people don't have jobs. When people are unemployed, their income is lower, so they pay less taxes, so tax revenues are lower. Government spending to directly and indirectly support the unemployed is higher. So if you created jobs, then incomes would rise, so tax revenues would rise and government spending would go down and the deficit would actually shrink. So everyone who's concerned about the deficit and the national debt should all be getting together and supporting full employment, true full employment immediately.
Stephanie Kelton, you have something to add?
Yeah, Matt's point is exactly right. If you can't break away intellectually, mentally, whatever, from the idea that deficits need to come down, then at least recognize that it's the deficit to GDP, right? It's a ratio. And you're so focused on the numerator, the top number in that, that you forget that if you want the ratio to fall, you grow the denominator. And the way that you bring down the deficit is by growing GDP, which is, by the way, exactly what happened when Clinton was in office and we got those budget surpluses. It was because the economy did so well. It was the first time, the only time in the last 35 years that we had one job opening for every job seeker. So as Matt said, it was full employment that balanced the budget.
The U.S. Treasury Department expects to hit the legal borrowing limit by the end of 2012, but says it can stave off the risk of default until sometime in early 2013 through the use of what it called extraordinary measures. What does both the debt ceiling debate and fiscal cliff say about our current fiscal and more broadly monetary policy and how they both need to change? Stephanie Kelton.
Well, I think it's just a really clear reflection of the fact that we didn't pay attention in 1971, that we just aren't aware of what this monetary system permits us to do. And it is that it permits us to achieve full employment domestically. We can do that. We just simply don't recognize that we have the capacity to do that, or we're so confused by what's taking place in Europe that we're too afraid to do that domestically.
Matthew Forstetter, what are you expecting to happen in the lead up to next year when we look at the debt ceiling, when we look at the fiscal cliff as it approaches? What do you expect to happen?
What I expect to happen is that little by little, through people like Stephanie getting the media attention that they deserve, people's understanding is going to start to change, and they're going to begin to understand that exactly what Stephanie said, we have changed our system, but we didn't change our paradigm. We're still on a gold standard paradigm in terms of our thinking. So they're going to begin to understand this, and when they do, they're going to realize that all of the things that they have been thinking about, the debt ceiling and the deficit and so on, are all have got to change.
It's the Fiscal Cliffhanger with a double feature of the Debt Ceiling Show as our team of economic experts weighs in on the potential fiscal policy crises and the resulting economic implications. Our guests are UMKC economics professors Stephanie Kelton and Matt Forstetter. Thank you for coming, professors.
You're welcome. Thanks
a lot. Thanks for having us.
And remember, you can subscribe to our podcast and access our entire archive of previous Central Standard shows at KCUR.org. Tune in tomorrow for a show that is one part hoedown and one part hootenanny. You won't want to miss the musical stylings of Maw. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with help from Danny Alexander. Up to Date is next with an exploration of the rise and fall of Anheuser-Busch. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.